morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me
is Mike Cosentino. Yes, we are molding minds today. We are brain training to make you just reasonable people that believes in things like feeding children and climate change.
Yeah, we actually have a
science.
Gary is here, Silent Gary Lemaster, and we actually have a philosopher here.
We have a philopher. We caught one.
Yeah,
so
we caught it. You know, they're hard to get a hand.
No pot of gold.
Yeah. Matthew Goodwin is a professor of philosophy.
Matthew Goodwin.
Yeah, up at NAU, Northern Arizona University. He's originally from Ohio.
Correct.
And how did you get interested in philosophy? I mean, I studied philosophy, and if you wanted to pick a field that you had less employment opportunities available to you, there wasn't one.
Radio.
Well, I think that that's wrong. Actually, there's a lot of employment opportunities. It's just that people only think of it in terms of being in academia. And I think actually we're really creative, thoughtful people, and we can come up with lots of good ideas. And actually we find that philosophy majors really do become very employable in a wide variety of fields.
A number of the writers in advertising agencies were philosophy majors.
Exactly.
Yeah, banks in New York all hired liberal arts people
exactly.
From English and philosophy and sociology and stuff. They want a generalist. I mean, and then they train them to make a lot of money for their company. But
part of my introduction was going to be that since we're having trouble in this country getting the population to believe the scientists regarding climate change, maybe they'll believe a philosopher when it comes
right.
to climate.
We are discussing climate change and global warming. And I think we should bring up the depletion of the ozone layer, which is a separate issue, folks, but it gets all mixed together. So tell us a little bit about how would we start? What's the evidence for global warming? And pretty much, I guess all the scientists, vast majority agree that there's global warming, agree that it's man-made.
Well, that aren't paid to think otherwise, but go ahead, Matthew.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of evidence, and if you ask scientists today what's the biggest scientific issue on their minds, they usually don't actually say climate change. They say instead it's the mass extinction that's being caused by climate change. So really climate change is yesterday's scientific issue. Now the issue is adaptation, and we have approximately 140,000 species going extinct every year now. And we need those species for adaptation to a new environment.
But most of those species are bugs, right?
Many of them, but now many of them are plants now.
That's interesting.
In the coral reef, like the Great Barrier Reef, I was reading an article this morning. They're trying to find more adaptive coral so they can save the reef.
Yeah, right. I know that coral's in terrible trouble. So climate change and the global warming has a whole lot of effects, rise of the sea level, melting glaciers. It's going to change weather patterns. It's going to make hurricanes less frequent but more intense, for example. It may shift when, for example, monsoons and hurricanes occur in Asia, which could really change the whole pattern of growing and producing food.
Yeah, it really makes the future unpredictable. And when you talk about the uncertainties in climate science today, that's really where most of the uncertainty is. We really don't know what the weather patterns are going to be like in certain regions. So if we have crops and agriculture in certain areas that we're accustomed to, where we have the infrastructure, that's where we don't know where we're going to have to move that infrastructure as there's going to be changes in the future.
I want to ask you, Matt, the Al Gore movie, as far as many of us are concerned, that was The Inconvenient Truth, was certainly a wake-up call, an introduction anyway. And then, of course, the right wing ridiculed it and has been for 10 years. I guess I think it just had its 10-year anniversary, so it's appropriate to be talking. Now, as I, you know, we're on radio, so nobody can see you, but as I sit around this room, I see these grizzled old men, and I see you. You know, do not, these guys have a face for radio. We have a younger man here that, do you remember the Al Gore? Did it have any impact on your life like it did on mine?
I do. It wasn't really news to me, though, because I had taken some science courses in college where the scientists were talking about this. But when I was in those courses, I felt like, okay, you know, these were electives for me. I was still studying philosophy. And I thought, okay, well, it's good that the scientists are on this now. And so I kind of continued my education in philosophy and felt like the scientists had it under control. I think the Al Gore movie really called attention to me to the fact that we still had not done anything in that time. And so that's when I really started thinking, okay, well, maybe philosophy has something to do with this as well. And I really do think that in some sense, philosophers do have a responsibility to try to work on these big ideas. These are big problems, big conceptual problems that we have to think through to figure out what are we going to do to address these issues.
What's your take on this? And there's a recent article in the Washington Post which shows that by 1986, they'd pretty much gotten a scientific handle on what's going to happen. There were two different scenarios. The less extreme one is the one that seems now the most agreed on. But 1986, a charge about climate change and global warming was led by a Republican named John Chafee. He was a Republican from Rhode Island. And so the science existed apparently even before that. And by the late 70s, most of the guys had figured out the whole, I guess, the physics of global warming, which is the gases hold in the temperature and so forth. 30 years later, there are almost, for example, no Republican senators who will dare talk about global warming. The whole thing has become very politicized. Originally, it was completely bipartisan, I believe. And now we're in the situation. We're in a situation where it was understood decades ago, and only now, I mean, the new Paris Agreement and so forth, are we making a lot of progress on this?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that it's actually conservative to want to conserve your resources, and that is something that has changed. I think there's one of the big problems is there's not a debate in the science. That, as you said, there's a debate that's among politics. So there's certain individuals and institutions that have kind of picked up on the misinformation that's out there and are allowing the propagation of that misinformation. And the internet and the blogs has really opened this up as a possibility to get a lot of misinformation out there. It's really amazing to me how many times a misleading article gets picked up and is three pages deep on a Google search before you can start finding anything that counters it. So it's a very effective way.
We find that across the board, right, that when we go, say, to the Benghazi controversy, it's these right-wing conspiracy theories. And then when you go to the second page, there's somebody who's examining them. Mm-hmm. What's driving this? Where are these articles? Where is this opposition coming? And where is it originating, I guess, is my question. Or is it? I know there's not a single source.
No, there's numerous think tanks is where I usually locate it. Some of the big ones are Heartland, the George Marshall Institute, the Cato Institute. These are places that employ people, really smart people. And in fact, many of them are trained in philosophy. And that's where I've started to notice is that philosophy trains people on common mistakes in reason, in reasoning. And the problem with these mistakes is they're very appealing, and it's very easy to fall for these mistakes. And once you start learning what the common mistakes are, you then can employ them. And that's what I'm finding a lot of times is people that are trained to know what a logical fallacy is, which distracts you from an argument, they're now using logical fallacies to distract people from the science.
Because they've been trained to know what it is, mm-hmm, and how to use it, mm-hmm, in order to not do it. It's like giving police training to criminals.
Right.
Well, we teach logical fallacies in English 101, at least some of us did. And yes, they're a very effective argument tool. And but there's a thing called ethics,
right.
Sir.
Right.
Now, philosophers don't worry about this, but I imagine.
No, we do.
That's all they worry about. Are you kidding? They'd spend 2 days on, you know, one paragraph on ethics. But the point is that it's the ethical. So Decatur Institute, the Heartland, whatever, these people have no ethics?
Well, you know, I think that they do, in many cases, believe in what they are arguing for. I think what they're arguing for ultimately, though, is
paycheck has got nothing
to
do with it.
They do believe that deregulation of all of the markets and deregulation of environmental control, that these are going to be better in the long run.
I see.
Some of them deny to Ayn Rand's philosophy.
Yeah, among others.
There's some of them that are apparently denying that global warming is taking place. And there's others who are against all the measures that people can figure out to do anything about it,
right.
And believe that there's the magic of the market will somehow solve this. And we were talking about the show. We were talking about the Amazon. And I think as a libertarian, you always assume that individual actions taken separately will produce the best for the whole core of people, for everyone. And if you look at the Amazon, for example, what makes sense if you're a farmer, your family is hungry, is chopping down huge swaths of forest and planting crops. But the whole process of this is destroying the Amazon forest, which is largely the lungs of the planet that's absorbing the extra carbon dioxide. Individual action leads to disaster. I mean, this happened in the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, where I'm from. Same kind of thing.
There's
right?
wealth and resources, and that's not a huge, you know, a secret. But talking to Matt Goodwin here, NAU philosophy guy, and we're talking about climate change. One of the things I remember from my professors is that they would they do some purpose setting. And as I think about climate change, I think about, is it important? To me, there's nothing more important. Everything pales to insignificance if we don't get this figured out. Am I just Chicken Little here? The sky is falling?
Well, it's easy to worry that you are being Chicken Little and overreacting, and there's plenty of people who will tell you that you are. But I think it's correct to notice that this is going to make everything a lot worse. Everything that we're trying to deal with, when we're dealing with industry, whether we're dealing with relations with other countries, when we're dealing with immigration, pretty much every issue on the table is going to be exasperated by climate change.
Tell us about immigration.
Well, there's a lot of good studies that whenever people hear me say this, they always balk. A lot of good studies that are showing that the rise of ISIS was perhaps in part connected to climate change. That's because Syria was experiencing a massive 10-year drought, as well as neighboring Iraq. There was a war that we started over there, and there were immigrants coming into Syria from Iraq. And then, of course, now there's immigrants coming out of Syria, and we've got the rise of ISIS in Syria itself. So it doesn't mean that there's a single cause that's climate change,
right.
But that if there's a drought at the same time that there's all these other things going on, it can make things a lot worse.
There's a drought in Sudan Somalia and lots of other places that it seems to do. And I think the American military actually has some fairly extensive studies of the impact of climate change on military issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the lead thinkers in the American military are thinking about the implications of this. Of course, they're thinking about it in military terms. What are we going to do when the climate change causes these masses of people to move? How are we going to contain it? How are we going to fight it? But there are other considerations, right?
I just want to say real quick, though, is that it is a destabilizing force. And when you have an unstable situation, that's when you have potentially dictators taking over and controlling situations.
I'm going to quote
I would point out that to deny climate change means that you have to not only deny the president, the findings of the president of the United States, the EPA, the State Department, the Defense Department, almost all of our university community, the UN, NASA, NOAA, the Oceanographic Institute, almost the entire scientific community, most of our religious leaders, including the Dalai Lama and Pope Francis, and virtually the entire international community. So if you can look at it from almost any aspect.
But I can have an opinion.
You can just have an opinion. It doesn't mean anything.
Just because I don't know anything doesn't mean I can't have an opinion, Gary. I have an opinion. I don't need to know facts. There's a difference between opinions and facts, philosopher.
Exactly.
What's the difference between opinion and fact?
Well, a fact is true. An opinion is a perspective that you may have on the truth. So we may have individual opinions about what is true, but we may not necessarily know what is true.
I want to add just one, thing to what Gary was saying, and that's the International Monetary Fund. It's a bunch of lefties and around the world, I guess. And they say that a global average temperature rise of 3 degrees Celsius, that's more than it would be in Fahrenheit, which the world's now pledged to avoid. That was what the agreement's about, would cost 2% of the global GDP. Now that doesn't sound, 2% doesn't sound like a big deal, but you were talking about destabilizing a sudden drop in 2% of the GDP globally would be extremely destabilizing politically and militarily, right?
Mm-hmm. And notice what that is that's a cost to the future. The future is going to have to pay for that. And people that are living in the future are going to be paying the cost of what we are doing now.
So besides the I feel like we didn't finish talking about immigration and climate change. It's so, we're talking about within the United States. Am I going to have, the people from L.A. living in my backyard?
I actually think that would be the reasonable thing to consider is that we have for so long now tried to think of our homes as stable, fixed places.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe we should move with the seasons and migrate like animals do, which now seems ridiculous to even consider. But now when we look at cities like Phoenix and LA getting hot and not having water sources, wow, instead of saying, well, let's maybe move someplace that has water and is a little bit cooler, right, we're going to try to pipe in more water from somewhere else, right, or figure out other ways to generate electricity so that we can climate control all of our buildings.
Very good. Well, what are the other things? What are the think tanks thinking about as far as solutions go? How do we fix this?
I mean, if there's no debate about whether global warming is taking place, there's just a debate about how much, how quickly, and the effects of it. Wait, Mike. If there's no debate about that, then what is the debate about?
Well, the debate is political. It's over what to do. What types of institutions are going to have to adapt and change, and in what ways? Can we change our transportation? Can we change our manufacturing? These are all the things that are going to have to be modified to adapt. But in addition to that, that's just the human element. There's also the animal and the plant element. Now, some scientists have proposed that we're going to call this era the Anthropocene. This is the era that's affected by human beings, it's shaped by human beings. And so now people are looking, for example, at the mountain up on the San Francisco peaks and saying, well, what kinds of trees are going to be able to survive on this mountain 50 to 100 years from now, and how can we help those trees adapt? Because the pace of this change is so quick that the trees will not be able to adapt.
So it won't be aspens and firs.
Right.
I see. It'll be
probably
salt
pinion.
Cedar.
Probably, yeah, it could be salt cedar. It could be pinion.
I see. Well, that's, I could live with pinion.
So that we're seeing, we were talking earlier about a mass distinction of a lot of species around the world, and I said it with mostly bugs, but it's a serious issue. And also these movements, if climate change takes place slowly, there's chance for the plants to adapt to it, for the animals to adapt to it, to move and shift.
Oh.
But if it takes place too rapidly, then they can't adapt as well, and we're going to lose more and more species. and things are going to change in extremely unpredictable ways. I mean, I think in northern Arizona, we're experiencing a monsoon now coming a little bit later. And so there's all these crazy factors, folks, because if the monsoon comes a week later, that opens the window for forest fires a whole nother week, which is extremely dangerous for us. So there's all these complex factors, right, affecting individual locales.
Let me ask you guys, do you think, because I didn't listen to your little two-letter word, if there is no argument on climate change, and, yes. You know, and that prefaced your argument.
Scientific argument about that it's happening.
Then Matt is talking about, you know, what we can do, what's going on. But if there is no, I guess the arguments against climate, because you got people on Facebook. I have people on Facebook that will argue just because it's connected in some way with liberals. It doesn't matter. Well, you know, it's almost, is it too late? In other words, all of those things, all of those arguments are absurd in the face of mass extinctions, of losing tens, dozens of species a year. You said 140. And some of these species we may count on, plants, not to mention medicine. Well, we still don't know where all the medicine comes from. We're losing species that we've never even tried to extract medicine.
I think you're making the important point here, everyone, which is that if there isn't really a scientific debate except about the quickness of this and about the complex local effects, in other words, will it cause a hurricane here or there? There's a lot of stuff we don't know. If there's no scientific debate, Matt, why is there this huge political debate, social, intellectual debate? Why do we have one political party, which is not true in a lot of places in the world, opposing the whole idea of climate change if there's no scientific basis for it?
Well, if you look at what's happening, we're talking about CO2, which is an invisible gas, and something that occurs over a fairly long period of time. When you're talking about the climate scale, you're talking at a bare minimum, the shortest scale is 30 years. None of my students in my classes have reached that scale yet, so they can't observe that change. So it's only once you get over 30 years that you start to be able to say, okay, maybe I've experienced some change in the climate. So this is not really something that we experience. It's not something that we see directly in front of us. And even a lot of the degradation of the species, the degradation of the Amazon forest, we don't see that. We don't see the harms that are occurring in the planet. We're isolated, especially if we're living in a city. So when you're in a city, you're now, you know, basically in a cocoon. You're in your car, you're in a train or a bus or in your office, and you're not out there in the world where you're able to actually encounter these changes.
The political argument against it seems to be coming from Republicans, and I'll point out that it's the only major political party in the world that denies climate change. But the political argument is more about business and jobs than anything else, which in effect is denying yet another aspect, in that addressing climate change in a relatively quick fashion could be a great opportunity for jobs in terms of new forms of energy, sustainable energy, and infrastructure. There's a number of ways in which we could actually benefit and create even more jobs than the oil and gas and coal industry. And the other thing I'd point out is that the effects of the climate change, which I've been following for some time, I've written a lot about it, is happening at a rate that the scientists who were considered the most extreme, were saying that 30 years was kind of the outlier. That was the limit. Those people are being proven right, and in many cases, the change is happening much more quickly than even the extreme predictions.
What Matt just said, though, is powerful, that we don't experience. I'm sitting in this air-conditioned office, and you know I'm going to get in my car, except for I'm wondering, well, what's going on with my fruit trees. And that, in my world, that does sort of enter into a philosophical level. But if I go down to an American bar, which I spend a considerable amount of time in, because that's where I believe...
Several American bars.
I believe that's where you find philosophy, the real philosophy majors.
There certainly are philosophers in bars. I was a bartender.
I go to a bar in Old Town Cotwood, and I go to a bar in Amsterdam. I'm going to have vastly different conversations on climate change. Mm-hmm. Those people, maybe I'm just being a liberal elitist, by the way, and that's what they call us, you know. Well, nothing's going to happen. We'll be okay.
In other words, you're educated.
Yeah, that's right. So
we used to call it edumacated in the tourist
industry. So I don't know what I'm saying here, other than that there are the news hasn't filtered down to the Cactus Cates.
I think Mike's making an important point is, and this is maybe a task for philosophy, if the scientific evidence is largely in, how do we, and we don't experience this personally very much, How do we talk to ordinary folks about this? Suppose I never liked school and I got out the hell out of there as soon as possible, and I don't do a lot of reading, and you start coming and telling me I've got climate change and I'm going to have to change the way I live and I can't eat hamburgers or whatever it is.
That's right.
What does philosophy
low on the food chain is, you know, a low fat hamburger.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's where you're drinking. That's a vegan perspective.
Well, I think you're right. No one wants to be told that what they're doing is wrong, and especially you don't want to be told that what you're doing is harming the planet or harming the future of humanity or anything like that. So no one wants to be told that I can't drive a pickup truck because this is going to harm the planet. So that's a quick way to shut people down and keep them from listening. So I think that one thing to do is to not point fingers, but to say this is a collective problem. This is something that we're all in on. That we all have to address, that we all have to put our heads into. And the innovation issue is a huge one. And this is the thing that I'm kind of amazed by is the resistance to the science is at the same time slowing down our technological innovation. The fact that we are still using 19th century technology, that is coal, for our energy source is really kind of embarrassing. I think that we really should be much more innovative, and I'm really struck by how much people are resisting innovation.
What's wrong with coal? Tell people briefly. What's wrong with using coal? We've used coal since the Industrial Revolution.
It's simply the dirtiest and produces the most CO2. It is the quickest way to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Well, what about the coal miners? You're going to put them all out of work if we stop using coal. We were talking about,
I think when you make that argument, essentially you're enslaving people to a particular industry. Instead of saying, let's innovate, let's get them into better jobs. I think that they would probably like better jobs.
It's one of the ironies that you know, a lot of people, business people and conservatives, especially talk about disruption to industries. And as a good thing, they look at, for example, Uber as disrupting the taxi cab industry as a good thing. It gets rid of unions and regulation and so on. And so there's all of this idea of having disruptive industries and change. Yet they absolutely refuse to even consider the possibility of an improved disruption of gas and oil and fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right.
They can't accept the idea that solar and wind industry is becoming cheaper than coal. I mean, the problem the coal industry has really is not so much with regulation, right? It's with the fact that right now natural gas is a lot cheaper. So why would you build a coal-fired plant when you can have less pollution and cheaper electricity with natural gas?
Well, in preparation for a future show, I was looking at GOSAR's, some of our congressmen's websites, that are against public lands and other things. But Gosar talks about Obama's war on coal as if it's, and so do some of the other Republican congressmen, as if it's a bad thing.
We were up in Escalante and we're eating in a diner. We talked to a coal truck driver in that area, and they still mine, even though it's a national monument, they still mine on the northern edge of the thing and in that area. And he was ranting and raving about Obama's war on coal and how we were going to run out of natural gas and how Obama's destroying his job. So forth and so on. So people feel hurt by this process of change. And I think in some ways, if you really just want to do what you're doing and you don't want to change what you're doing, there is a problem.
Well,
right?
I hear the NGS. I mean, I lived in Page for 4 years and I saw the brown cloud and breathed it. But I also hear that, you know, the providing, you know, Navajos high-tech jobs for 35, 38, now 40 years, and that's not a lie. I mean, you know, it is what it is. It's this giant tea kettle up there that boils water and makes a lot of turbines.
But what's interesting, though, is that the Navajo are then breathing that pollution, and the Navajo don't get the electricity.
Well,
so they're really just not getting the benefits of that coal plant.
Yeah, if you're going to burn it, at least get the benefit of it. You know, but yeah, you're right. Don't send it to L.A. Well, but as a company, that's American capitalism.
Well, so. Mike, what do you think would reach people like that you talk to, who? When they hear the words climate change or global warming, don't they just sort of turn off? They just think, the liberals are going to tell me something, that I've got to do something that I don't want to do, and they just turn off. How do you talk to them?
I got it. Matthew Goodwin, philosophy maven from Northern Arizona University, has provided me with this insight, and that is we need to send out an army of these guys to the bars of Arizona and the world, for that matter. These guys, we have to fund them, which would be terrible. We have to buy them no better than PBR, maybe a Jameson's once in a while when I show up. But seriously, and I think in order to change, to do a grassroots change of opinion, people like Matt have to go on shows like this. And maybe, I don't know, the Kiwanis Club, if he could get on the agenda. I mean, if they didn't run him out.
Yes,
you and I, they'd run out, but he's so
many,
know,
of the,
young and
so
cute.
So many of the clubs just don't want to be political. Even some of the environmental hiking clubs and stuff don't want any political discussion. And somehow something
that's
seems
true.
Like a scientific fact that's been discovered, like the fact that the world's round, it's been discovered, is controversial politically, and therefore it's prohibited to talk about it in a lot of ways in a lot of situations. And I don't know if you've ever been accused of being political in your philosophy classes for bringing up this kind of thing.
I have not been yet. You know, there's been maybe little statements here and there where people think that it is political. But I think usually the students that come in, they realize this is, first of all, it is a scientific issue that has become clouded by the politics. And at least the students that come into my class realize we've got to really figure out how can we communicate this. And
some things like this just simply can't be considered political. Mm-hmm. This is not a political issue. It's a scientific issue. It's reality. The same is true of our gun problem in this country. We've turned these things into political policy issues, and it's really more a matter of humanity and reality. Mm-hmm. And we have to stop this whole notion that we can't talk about them because they are political. I've got some neighbors in my neighborhood who when I was addressing the water issue, you know, and trying to limit the heavily water intensive plants in a desert in our neighborhood, told me, well, what do I care? I'm 70, 80 years old. I'm not going to be around here. You know, how do you address that? It's, you know, as a philosophy, I mean, that is truly a philosophy issue.
Good question. This is still what I'm trying to figure out. And right now, really, we're dealing with some generational issues, I think, as well, as people have retired and have worked with a particular mindset towards their retirement and now are able to enjoy life in the way that they've wanted to enjoy their life for a long time. It's very hard to tell people that you shouldn't be driving an RV or something like this if that's been their dream all their life.
These are the very same people. I mean, these people have kids and grandkids that apparently they don't care about. I don't have either. I don't have kids or grandkids, and I actually care about the environment and the water usage and global warming, things of that sort. I honestly can't figure out how to get through to these
people. It's an element of compassion, isn't it, to be concerned about not just yourself and your group and your family, but everyone in the world, right? I mean, that sounds real idealistic, but that I think compassionate people, truly compassionate people, care about the whole world, and you care about nature, and you also care about future generations. I think there's even a term for it, where you have some concern about what's going to happen. There's a generosity of the heart, where you're concerned that minor inconveniences that might affect you will help people way down the line.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to where Matt may be more comfortable on that, and academic discussion here. Going back to logical fallacies, a term and a system close to my heart because I see it, and you don't have to be necessarily a philosophy major, and you don't have to be an English major. Who taught argument for a while, but you don't have to be anything, but you can feel it. You know there's something wrong with the argument when they're attacking people. Donald Trump is a perfect example. You can talk about
personal lack of compassion,
brilliant
his
ideas,
response,
but you attack the person as if the person has something to do with the idea. The popularity, in other words, anything that's popular is good. The false dilemma, it's got to, and the right wing is really good at this. Well, it's got to be this or this. No, there's like 50 choices here. At least there's three. It's not just these two things. So what I'm getting at, Matt, is get your ass out there and start educating people on logical fallacies. I've only touched the surface, and you know it. You know the kinds of really both blatant and subtle logical fallacies that people employ. I mean, it's like now, it's the technological age, it's 2016. Used to be,
2015,
2016, whatever it is, that you'd have a logical fallacy in an argument from a politician or from somebody on.
But now, what do you do about? Is there a question hiding in there?
No.
Mike, what do you do about 50 of them? The title of Al Gore's, and Al Gore was one of the first people to ever pick in politics, not only on the internet. He was sort of really involved in that. You can read the early document, but also in climate change. He picks it up right when he first gets in Congress. He picks it up in the mid-70s. And the title of his movie was An Inconvenient Truth, Mike.
Yeah.
And I think I would say to Matt, isn't the one part of the problem, what we were talking about earlier, is that people feel that the truth of climate change is really inconvenient for the society. It'll cut production or something. It's inconvenient for them personally, and so they don't want to know it.
Exactly.
So what can Mike do about that?
Mike can help educators, as you pointed out, that we need to educate people, help us get funding into schools so that they can do the education as well.
We're doing our best.
It's interesting that we can't cut anything from the coal industry, but there's no problems cutting it out of education.
I'd like to ask about the role of religion in this, because religion is philosophy in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a a big part of this discussion. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, you know, one way I sometimes describe philosophy is it's kind of an intermediary between science and religion, that they really overlap. So philosophy has a slightly different approach than science. It doesn't build up, accumulate evidence and tests and experiments like science does, but it does use reason. And, of course, even in religion, there is a use of reason. You reason through your belief. Try and figure out, you know, what do I believe and why do I believe it? And religion and philosophy deal more with the intangibles that science cannot give you. You can't cut down a tree and find a place in the tree that's going to tell you what we should or should not do with our forests. That's the intangible, what we should do. So religion and philosophy deal more with those intangibles. And so I think this is also kind of a problem sometimes, even in our regard of science as the ultimate arbiter of truth, is that it's not always going to tell us exactly what we should do. It can tell us what we can do. We can build weapons of mass destruction, but that doesn't tell us whether we should or should not use them. So that's more of an ethical issue that philosophy and religion can help us figure out.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the situation? I mean, we've been talking about it for 40 minutes, and we've all experienced the pessimistic side of it, or at least the frustration at having a scientific issue that's settled. But there are really, as you say, there are value issues. Like, do you care about people in the future? Do you care about the world as a whole? Maybe you don't.
I'm still a little bit mixed. There's still a bit of pessimism because we still really haven't done the heavy work that's required to start addressing climate change. But I am very optimistic when I deal with my students and my classes up at NAU because they know what's going on and they know the science. They are very familiar with this. They have a tremendous amount of knowledge and they also have a tremendous amount of compassion. They're really concerned about their future. And so as long as we can kind of stand up and help them, I think, and kind of get their backs and help them start this transition, I'm very optimistic.
Along those lines, I think you can look at Germany and England and a lot of European countries, Denmark, that have committed to sustainable, renewable energies and have, in a large part, replaced coal and the fossil fuels, and are doing it at a very rapid pace, where it's a snail's pace in the U.S.
Norway has just banned cutting down old growth forests, basically. It's now illegal in Norway to do that.
Well, those are the solutions. In other words, we're moving toward them, I guess the rest of the world is. And even the United States is, as far as, they're going to hate on Obama, but at least we are making having the discussion moving toward less greenhouse gases and all of the other things that will slow down climate change and mass extinction. And
we should mention that our heart goes out to all the people injured the families of the killed in Orlando. Yeah. It is just an absolutely horrible tragedy. I think you have to look at the tragedy first, and then you can have politics and beliefs about it. But the amount of suffering caused is just immense, particularly in the gay and lesbian community in Orlando, that they would be targeted like this, the largest mass shooting. I don't have any brilliant thing to add to it. It's just that I think that I feel really saddened by the whole process.
To change the topic, I want to put in a plug for our sponsor. Democrats of the Red Rocks has a meeting coming up this Thursday at 8 a.m., June 16th.
Our wonderful supporters who have an office somewhere.
And it's Harriet Young is going to be making a presentation.
Harriet Young. The always entertaining Harry Young, one of your
political science
adjunct colleagues.
Yeah, professor up at NAU.
Where's the office? Door office.
I don't have the address on me, but the Door office now has regular hours in the afternoon. I believe it's from 11 to 3. The hours are going to get longer and longer. I had two students from NAU come by and see if I was a Democrat. So they're out there already.
2855 West State Route 89A.
All right, right on the main drag. 28 what?
2855.
All right. You can drop by. You can bring money. You can chat politics. You can make phone calls. You can
make donations to our radio program.
You can make donations to our radio program and all kinds of things. Please, please, please listen to our podcasts and all our shows on vbid.org, vbid.org. Thank you.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.